final investigator interviewed for this program is Dr. Thomas Herzog, who's been a leader in the GOG, Gynecologic Oncology Group. And in our conversation, Dr. Herzog reviewed some of the key prior GOG trials, current studies, and future directions.
It's a cooperative group that's under the auspices of the National Cancer Institute and receives funding from the National Cancer Institute. So public funding is involved and obviously adds a layer of complexity in terms of execution of trials and design of trials. Where we are right now with GOG in regards to ovarian cancer is that we're a bit of a crossroads in that we've had some landmark trials that have gone extremely well, and all of which have come out in the last 10 or 11 years. So the first one that really has probably made a difference in everybody's practice is GOG-111. GOG-111 introduced the taxane era, and GOG-111 simply substituted paclitaxel for cyclophosphamide. A single substitution resulted in improvement in overall survival.
Now, so, what kind of patients were this?
These were stage 3 and right. 4 ovarian cancer patients. These patients had a fair amount of bulk disease that was left behind. And I think the thing that was most remarkable was that the median survival went from 24 months to 38 months just by making that single drug substitution. So this really introduced the taxane era into clinical practice. But the standard at the end of the day in looking at the results of GOG-111 was really one of a cumbersome inpatient regimen in that the paclitaxel was administered over 24 hours and cisplatin also with its need for hydration and so on makes this a somewhat difficult regimen to give. It's not very patient friendly and it's not really very physician friendly in terms of being able to administer this in the community. So I think the next landmark trial that really impacted on ovarian cancer patients was that of GOG-158. Now, this particular trial was limited to patients that were optimally debulked. That means patients that had less than 1 centimeter residual disease as their largest tumor after primary surgery. These patients were stage 3 and 4, meaning they had disease in the upper abdomen at the time of diagnosis. And they were then randomized to the winner of GOG-111, that cumbersome inpatient regimen that included the 24-hour paclitaxel and cisplatin, versus a much more user-friendly outpatient regimen consisting of carboplatin with only a 3-hour paclitaxel infusion. And many people thought that that could change the efficacy. And while many in the community had already said, well, due to convenience, we're going to change, many were concerned that it could actually compromise efficacy. As it turns out, there was no difference, no statistical difference between those two arms. And in fact, the carbo arm actually is a little bit ahead of the cisplatin, which may be due to the fact that a very high AUC was used in that trial. It was 7.5, which is higher than what most people use in the community, which is usually somewhere between 5 and 7.
In these studies that you just discussed and in general in GOG trials, is it the gynecologic oncologist putting patients on study, med-oncs, or both?
It's definitely both. And we can't do these trials unless we have buy-in from both communities. And I think that's very important to stress. As you know, the committees and the protocol committee as well as the site committee, the ovarian committee specifically, are comprised of both academic medical oncologists and academic gynecologic oncologists. And we're trying to also get more community input because I think one of the things that has been true is many of these trials have been designed in a vacuum. And we'd rather have these trials have more wide applicability as well as inclusion criteria, and then perhaps do the subset analysis thereafter if there seems to be questions that arise.
What do we know right now about how patients with ovarian cancer are managed across the United States, urban versus rural, academic versus non-academic? You know, how do the patients sort of track through in terms of gynecologic oncologists and med-oncs?
It's been very interesting because it's been one of my questions is to try to break these down into what are different groups in this country doing with patients with ovarian cancer. And when I say that, I'm limiting my comments to epithelial ovarian cancer and to advanced stage, generally, those that require chemotherapy. You can include stage 2 in that by and large, but certainly stage 3 and 4. Having said that, If we look at where we are today, the vast majority, if we paint the large picture, would be painted with carboplatin and paclitaxel, probably as high as 85 to 90% of the people receiving that regimen.
Who's IV. Treating them?
It's a mixture. The majority are treated still by medical oncologists.
Really? So the gynecologic oncologist does the surgery and then refers the patient?
It's due more to absolute numbers. Where there are communities where GYN oncology is readily available, you'll find that they may be doing the slight majority.
Who actually is doing the surgery in general?
Well, that's a good question, too. Overall,
there aren't that many gynecologic oncologists, right, are there? How many are there?
It's estimated, well, it's less than 1,000.
Yeah.
So it's estimated that we're really dealing with probably about 40% of the ovarian cancer patients are actually operated on by a gynecologic oncologist, which is much higher than endometrial cancer, which is much higher than what we've seen in a lot of other areas.
Should it be 100%?
Well, there's data to support the fact that a surgery conducted by a gynecologic oncologist results in better outcome. Now, the initial studies, I think, are somewhat questionable because they were conducted by gynecologic oncologists. But there's actually been some data that's come from the NCI conducted by medical oncologists who've also shown the same outcome in that survival is improved. And so debulking is one of the variables that we can change. So if you look at prognostic variables for ovarian cancer, we can look at age, we can look at grade of tumor, we can look at stage. There's a lot of different molecular markers we can look at. But the only one that we can change is that of their debulking status. And so we can alter that. And, you know, the old age argument is there a difference between those tumors you can debulk in terms of biology? As best as we can control for it, the answer is no. And that, hence, in multivariate analysis, debulking still stands up as an important part of the treatment initially to bring the patient to the best outcome.
I never really quite understood. I think we've gotten the message that, you know, GYN oncs do the surgery better, but or the patients do better. But I, in a way, kind of haven't been able to figure it out. Is it technically or is it judgment? Or what's the difference?
Well, I think it's a combination. I think the biggest thing is the ability to achieve a higher optimal debulking rate. So we do think that that makes a difference.
So is it technical that they know how to do it, or what is it?
I think so.
Well, give me an example of what you would encounter in the belly or what a GYN onc would do that maybe a gynecologist in practice wouldn't.
Okay, well, I think that that's an easy example. So if you have an OBGYN, they don't do any of their own bowel surgery. They don't do any of their own bladder surgery traditionally. They tend to take out uteruses and take out adnexa. Versus if you have a gynecologic oncologist, they're trained in removing bowel if need be, spleen, liver, diaphragm stripping, removing the omentum, of course. And the other important segment of this is properly staging the patient. So lymph nodes becomes important in what appears to be an apparent early stage cancer. So if it appears the cancer is confined to the ovary, in the retroperitoneum, in those that have apparent early stage cancer, because it upstages them about a third of the time. They go from maybe not requiring any chemo if they were a grade one to requiring six cycles of chemotherapy. So it makes a big difference.
So in general then, when you see OBGYNs, as you call them, doing surgery in ovarian cancer, do they know ahead of time the patient has ovarian cancer, or do they just sort of find out?
Well, we'd like to think that the majority of the time that they're operating on these patients, it was due to the fact that they did not recognize that the patient had cancer preoperatively.
What would they be operating on them for? With what
pelvic mass. The problem is that as the mass gets larger, the patient gets older, and there's bilaterality, meaning involving two of the ovaries, the chances of this being a cancer grow precipitously. And so if you look at someone who's older, has any evidence of ascites and a large mass, this is clearly someone that probably should be opened or have readily available access to a gynecologic oncologist.
Is that happening?
It depends on the community. In some places, yes. In other places, they've been slower to adapt.
Do you think that a OBGYN who finds themselves in a woman's belly and finds out that they have ovarian cancer should just sort of get out?
I think that they should remove the ovary if possible so that we can get a diagnosis and remove what tumor they can easily. But I wouldn't recommend they get in over their head in terms of surgical technique because these can be very bloody tumors and you can get into more trouble. And then that delays definitive care for the patient.
I want to explore some of the other advances that have occurred through the GOG and other research entities in terms of ovarian cancer and also where we are right now in terms of current clinical trials.
If we look then at the next large trial that's really, you could probably put it into one of two categories, that being landmark or provocative, that is GOG-172. And this was the third trial of three trials that looked at the role of giving some of the therapy intraperitoneally, which means putting a catheter in and dumping the drug directly into the peritoneal cavity. And in that trial, we saw a median survival of 66 months for those patients that received a component of their care intraperitoneally versus 50 months. And these were stage 3 ovarian cancer patients. So what does that tell you? Well, first of all, that's a pretty big difference in terms of survival. So it was almost 17 months difference, number one. Number two, the other thing that's very encouraging is that now in stage 3 ovarian cancer, certainly advanced stage, we now have median survivals that eclipse 5 years, which I think is very encouraging.
What's the tumor-free survival at 5 years or 10 years?
Well, it's usually approximately about half that. If you look then at the other issue that's raised with 172, though, is there was a significant amount of toxicity in that almost 60% of the women were unable to finish all 6 cycles of chemotherapy.
Now, was this local or systemic toxicity?
Both. So it was due to catheter failure, it was due to myelosuppression, it was due to neuropathy, it was due to a number of issues. So
were the systemic issues different in the intraperitoneal arm as opposed to the systemic arm?
They were. There was about a 3-time increase in most of the non-hematologic toxicities in the IP arm versus the IV arm.
Was there more drug given?
There was more drug, and I think that's one of the issues that really needs to be noted and one of the criticisms of the IP trials to date. The first trial, Dave Albert's trial, was the cleanest. It just didn't use the drugs that we currently use, so the applicability of comparing cis and cyclophosphamide, it makes it a little more difficult.
Why was it cleaner, though?
Well, it was cleaner because the only thing they changed was the route of delivery.
Same drugs.
That's right.
Same dose.
That's right. Versus what we have in the second trial, Mari Markman's trial, there was a lot more drug given. In fact, even in the intraperitoneal arm, they started off with 2 courses of IV carbo with an AUC of 9.
I guess it's almost, when you put it intraperitoneally, it's essentially becoming systemic.
Well, that's the question, I think. You know, it's really, are we really looking at a depot delivery system, or are we looking at this concept that the cancer cells are being bathed by the chemotherapy and it's peeling them off like an onion?
I assume it's both,
layer by layer.
Right?
We don't know.
What do we know about blood levels after intraperitoneal therapy?
We know that there, if you look at Dr. Krasner's data that was presented a couple of years ago now at ASCO, it's very interesting. She did some PK data, and it looks like you have a pattern that looks very similar to what's seen with the IV, with the exception of the initial spike that you get with the IV.
Right now, what do you consider standard of care in terms of stage 3 and intraperitoneal?
Well, I think that the standard of care is still clearly a platinum and a taxane. The route of delivery, I think, can be debated. What I'm doing in my own practice is if I have a patient who has a good performance status, is young, wants to be aggressive, I certainly make it clear to them that IP appears to offer an advantage that they should strongly consider. And in fact, I have many of those patients choose to go on IP. For that patient who has either an impaired performance status or is very elderly, I will bring it up as a matter of being complete in the discussion, but by no means do I encourage it. In most cases, they tend not to go on it when they hear about the toxicity.
What do you think is going on across this country in terms of treatment? Are people in general having those options presented to them?
Well, that's going back. We didn't finish where we were before with talking about the patterns that we've seen, and it's very interesting. And the biggest difference in therapy is in the arena of the intraperitoneal route of delivery.
Between the gynox and the medox?
Stark difference between the two subspecialties, but also a stark difference between community versus academic, including within either GYN or MedOnc. What we found is that you're most likely to use intraperitoneal chemotherapy if you're an academic gynecologic oncologist. You're least likely to use it if you're an community medical oncologist. And then there's shades of gray in between, and it's sort of a toss-up then between community GYN oncs and academic med oncs.
So perfectly healthy 55-year-old woman says to me, What kind of numbers are we looking at, intraperitoneal versus non-intraperitoneal? What numbers would you give her for problems locally from the catheter?
We've gotten better with the catheter. If you look at more contemporary data from other centers, it's probably about 10 to 15% of the time that we have catheter failure.
Failure or infection?
It could be either. That causes us a problem to discontinue therapy with the catheter.
From the patient's point of view, is it morbid? Is it life-threatening? Is it a pain in the neck? You know, how does it, what does it fit in when
I
you have problems?
I think pain in the neck probably summarizes it the best. They do have more intra-abdominal pain having that catheter in there. It's not so much pain as it is just sort of a nuisance. It's discomfort.
How long is it in for?
It's in throughout the course of therapy. We generally put these in.
Which is how long?
We usually give 6 cycles.
So that's what, 6 times 3?
Right.
So during that time, are they walking around? Or are they
Everything
taped to their belly and all? How often do they get the treatment?
We very often use, different centers use different catheters, but I most commonly use a vascular type port that we put into the peritoneal cavity in the right upper quadrant. And so, of course, that's then supported cast, so it's buried under the skin, and we use a Huber needle for access. So they don't have anything dangling out their abdomen.
So that's what you'd say about local issues. What do you tell them comparatively? Systemic versus, is it intraperitoneal alone or with systemic usually?
Well, remember, when we say IP versus IV, we don't mean all the therapies given IP.
Right.
Because a component of it's still given IV, but the majority of it's given IP.
So what do you say to the woman when she says, okay, what about everything else? And you've talked about what goes on in my belly. What about how I'm going to feel, systemic, everything else? How would you compare it?
I discuss the quality of life data with them from the trials. And clearly, the quality of life is lower if you take the therapy intraperitoneally.
Because of systemic problems or the catheter?
I think both. I think that the large part of it, though, is systemic. I think there is more fatigue. I think that if you look at the rate of infection, it's about 3 times as much. The rate of grade 3-4 neuropathy is about 3 times as much. So those are significant factors to consider because neuropathy, obviously, if you're a long-term survivor, has significant impact because that neuropathy may not clear to zero.
Doctor, is this going to decrease my chance of dying of ovarian cancer?
We think that it probably will, based on the 3 studies that were done and based on the aggregate of the literature at this point. The NCI issued a clinical alert bulletin at the same time that 172 was published in January of 2006. And the NCI clinical alert bulletin gave a pooled hazard ratio, meaning that the risk reduction of death was about 21%. If you had your therapy delivered intraperitoneally as a portion of it versus all systemically IV.
Specifically, then, in your own hands, when you sit down with an otherwise healthy woman, 55, 60, yeah. 65, and you lay these things out, what do they tend to choose?
They tend to choose IP.
I would think so.
They do.
I mean, that sounds like the right numbers to me.
It's very interesting because a lot of the choice, I think, revolves around how the counseling is conducted, as often occurs in medicine. And so if the physician who's doing the counseling is not very enthusiastic or is really trying to steer the patient one way or the other, that can have, I think, a profound impact on what the patient eventually chooses. We see that with clinical trial enrollment and so on. I think it's an area that has been largely ignored and for a number of reasons that I think still need to be teased out. I think toxicity is a valid concern, and it needs to be looked at, but toxicity tends to be the cloak that everyone seems to be hiding behind when I think there may be other things such as reimbursement, chair time, the fact that you have to involve someone else to put the catheter in.
Doc time.
I think, correct. I think there's a lot of other factors that we need to look at that are also playing a role. I think education's a big part of it, but I'll tell you this, there have been a lot of initiatives to do education, and in fact, over the last 2 years, there have been in almost every national meeting, symposiums and so on, debates of pro versus con to flush out all these issues. And in fact, so much so, I'm the course director for the SGO's state-of-the-art care in ovarian cancer course that's coming up. And we decided to change the subject matter, to your point, because I want to know why people aren't using it. And so the debate's really going to revolve around what are the reasons why people are not using it. And so I have Deb Armstrong, who was the principal investigator, who's obviously very pro-IP. And I have Bill McGuire, who is in the community now. who was the principal investigator on GOG 111, incidentally. And he's not quite as gung-ho on IP, although he admits that...
Why?
Well, I think the toxicity and implementation is the issue that he's most concerned with. So it'll be interesting to see how we flush that out, because I'd like to change the dialogue into not, is it good, is it bad? Because we know the good and we know the bad. The question is, what barriers are there that are keeping this from getting into the community?
You know, I always try to think about clinical issues as they cross tumor barriers, because I know oncologists see that. They go from one room to ovarian to lung, et cetera.
Absolutely.
I was thinking when you were talking about this issue about, again, this issue of adjuvant chemo and non-small cell lung, and one of the points that comes out there with the lung investigators is these people went through a thoracotomy to try to get cured. So chemo in that context is different than somebody who had, you know, breast lump removed. And, you know, debulking surgery, I'd say, is a little bit closer to thoracotomy.
Absolutely. It's a very invasive procedure. Vertical incision from their xiphoid to their pubis often, and it's debilitating.
So these people have agreed to go through that, and now you're saying, will you go through some additional toxicity?
Right. They've made an investment, absolutely.
Right. What's the median age of diagnosis? Around 60, right?
Yeah, in most of the studies, it's anywhere between 63 and 66, somewhere in there.
And just like breast cancer and all the other tumors in older people, you have your octogenarians in the older people. What about the approach to patients in that age group in particular?
Well, it's a very, very good question. The GOG is currently debating a trial that's known as GOG 606, which would be a neoadjuvant trial in which the patients would receive chemotherapy IV systemically for 3 cycles. And then the decision would be made as to whether these patients are good candidates for any type of debulking procedure. And you may limit that somewhat, but try to remove as much tumor as possible and then finish up with 3 more cycles of chemotherapy. And so we have some evidence from Europe as well as some studies from the United States that say that you probably don't hurt the patient by doing that. And in these patients that are either heavily performance challenged or geriatric, it might be a nice approach. The other thing is that, and I'm actually one of the people that have been writing the protocol, it's very difficult because we don't have a good baseline with this. We have very small studies, largely, so they haven't helped us in terms of getting a baseline.
Specifically related to older people?
Exactly. So this whole field of geri-oncology is really an emerging field, because part of the protocol that we have written is to look at pharmacokinetics, quality of life issues using a geriatric assessment scale that's been developed. And there may be some very big differences in terms of our normal assumptions, even in terms of PK data, that may change how we dose these patients. It may be better to give weekly, for example, than it is to give every 3-week boluses.
Yeah, the only trial I can think of right now that I know about, there may be others, you know, major cooperative group studies specifically focused on elderly people, is the CALGB adjuvant breast study, which is, you know, a great study. HIMARS is doing it. But again, that's sort of a 65 age. And what I hear from oncologists in general, not so much ovary, is concerns about the 80-plus year-old patient.
We're targeting above 75.
Interesting.
So you have to have a very impaired
above
performance
75.
Status in to get in before 75. It's 75 any performance status. So that's what we hope would comprise the greatest group
in
this study.
Well, that's a great idea. I hope you can do it.
We hope so, too. But there's a lot of barriers.
Yeah, I know. But yeah, I've seen those barriers kill other trials, too. What else is going on? What are the other current GOG trials right now?
The 2 trials that are of interest, we talked about the maintenance trial and follow-up from 178, you know, looking at this whole concept of maintenance and whether there's an advantage or not, and that's being answered by GOG 212. Then as we move and look at frontline therapy, the current high-priority trial is GOG 218, and what that trial does is look at the role of incorporating a biologic, an anti-angiogenic bevacizumab. So the thought here is that from our 170 series, which is our biologic series, which had a mixture of recurrent tumors that were platinum sensitive and platinum resistant, which is just basically defined as to when they recur relative to 6 months. If it's less than 6 months, they're platinum resistant. Greater than 6 months, they're platinum sensitive. In that particular trial, we found an almost 20% response rate using bevacizumab as a single agent. So not using it in combination with any other cytotoxic.
You put patients on that study?
We did.
You yourself, individually?
Yep.
Did you see patients respond yourself?
Yes.
Were you surprised?
A little bit.
I imagine so.
In fact, I had one patient that had ascites, and the ascites went away after three cycles.
That's what I've been hearing, and the question of, is this just anti-tumor effect or something that has to do with interstitial pressure or something else?
I think it's a combination with the preferential way it works on the ascites. You know, there certainly seems to be a clear biologic effect, though, in terms of pleural effusions, ascites, those types of things.
And again, what I'm hearing is that it seems to last pretty long. Is that what you've
pretty
seen?
Pretty durable response. Out of the 170Q, the progression-free survival of all the drugs that have been looked at historically was the best with bevacizumab.
And what was seen in terms of side effects and toxicity?
Well, it was interesting because in that particular trial, not a lot was seen in the way of toxicity.
No bowel perforations.
Some hypertension, you know, some of the normal things that you see with bevacizumab. There were no GI perforations. There was then a subsequent series by Dr. Garcia that looked at combining it with cyclophosphamide at metronomic doses. And then there was a third series with Steve Canistra, who treated heavily pretreated patients. And in that particular series, they had an 11% incidence of GI perforation. There since have been several other institutions that have reported their experience, including Washington University in St. Louis. And what we found overall is that you're looking at probably somewhere between a 7-8% incidence of GI perforations, which is very interesting because it's still considerably higher than what you see even in the colorectal literature, which is about 3%.
I guess the issue is this related to the extent of disease in the belly?
Well, it's unclear because obviously they've gone back and tried to profile these patients, and some of these patients had very little disease and they still perforated. It does seem to be related to several things. One is bowel distension. So if these patients had some underlying bowel distension, which could be from disease, as you bring up, or it could be due just from adhesions from all the prior surgeries that they've had, or the other prognostic factor that seems to be operative is how many prior cycles have they had? How heavily pretreated are these patients? So in the adjuvant setting up front, it's probably not a problem. So if we get back to where the active trials are right now, the first trial is GOG-218. It looks at bevacizumab up front, and it's in three arms. The first arm is placebo straight through using carbopaclitaxel standard IV dosing. The second arm uses bevacizumab cycles 2 through 6. Along with the standard dosing, followed by arms 1 and 2, 15 months of placebo. The third arm has bevacizumab with the chemo, followed by 15 months of bevacizumab. So the good news about this is that patients have the opportunity to have bevacizumab, which is a very promising agent, in their regimen. The difficult part of selling this particular trial is that you have a third chance of getting none of the study drug, and you have a two-thirds chance of not getting all the benefits of what we think would be also including a maintenance portion of it. So it's been enrolling...
Stage 3 and 4.
Let me just qualify that, because originally it was suboptimal only, and to try to speed enrollment, what they've done now, since we don't have a replacement for anything IP, is they've allowed gross optimal disease, meaning any disease that you can see, even though it's less than 1 centimeter, they would also be eligible. So this would be a frontline trial that would introduce bevacizumab as a potential third agent, if you will. But these patients, if they chose to go on trial, would not be able to get intraperitoneal chemotherapy up front.
What about Bev plus intraperitoneal therapy?
That's a great question, and it's a question that right now is trying to be settled. So 172, Deb Armstrong's trial, as I said, came out in January of 06. And really, since even before that time, the GOG has been trying to develop a study that would follow up from those results. So we have something right now that looks a little bit like IP carboplatinum, substituting for the cyst to see if we can get less toxicity, make it more user-friendly and more compact, versus also adding yes or no bevacizumab into that equation as well. So we're looking at probably at least a three-arm trial in which some people are arguing for bevacizumab in all three of the arms, some are arguing for it in two arms. As you can see, though, we don't have a completed trial that's gone through all the hoops that it needs to go through in terms of agreement.
What about wound healing and bevacizumab, and how long do you have to wait?
It's a very good question. So what's generally done with most of these studies, not all of these studies, has been based on no clear data, the omission of bevacizumab with the first cycle of chemotherapy. So traditionally, they've been giving it for cycles 2 through 6.
When does it usually start after
surgery? We usually start chemotherapy within 3 to 4 weeks of the surgery, and often in some centers maybe as early as 1 to 2 weeks out. So how long out? If you look at the product insert, they want at least 4 to 6 weeks based on the half-life and some experience in vitro.
And is that what this turns out to be? It seems like it would be at least 4 weeks, probably six.
It does. With not doing it till the second cycle, you're pretty assured that that's not going to be a problem. And I'll also point out, though, there's some phase two data with some studies that are non-GOG in which bevacizumab is given with the first cycle. And to date, from my understanding, there have not been any serious problems with doing that.
Where do you see, if at all, bevacizumab fitting in non-protocol therapy right now of ovarian cancer?
Well, it's interesting because there was just a trial that was activated in the recurrent setting, and it's at the IRBs right now. It hasn't opened yet, and it should be opening shortly, but there have been no patients enrolled to date, and that's GOG 213. So this particular trial is complex in that they're trying to answer two questions, and this is in platinum-sensitive patients. So these are recurrent platinum-sensitive patients with ovarian cancer. First question they're trying to answer is, should you take these patients back to the operating room or not and re-debulk them? So there's that portion of it.
Randomized?
Interesting. So you say whether you think the patient's a, quote, candidate for the surgery or not a candidate. If the patient is a candidate and they go in the yes category, they're then randomized to surgery or no surgery. But as you very quickly pointed out, there's a problem there because there's some selection bias that could obviously go into that.
There's a problem about getting people to agree to that.
That's right.
I mean, this is having an operation or not.
That's right. So there's certainly some issues there.
Are people going on that study?
Well, we'll find out.
Oh, it's just
very shortly.
Started.
And then the second question that's being asked is, what's the role of bevacizumab in that setting? And they're giving carboplatin paclitaxel with Bev, with maintenance Bev, until progression. So there's not even an endpoint to the Bev in that particular trial. So that's the question that's being answered.
That's the lung thing. It's exactly what happened in lung.
Exactly.
And it worked.
Right. In terms of off-protocol, we're seeing a lot of use of bevacizumab. People are using it with various cytotoxics. No particular pattern emerging.
Only recurrent, or what about in the, what I'd call the adjuvant setting?
People are using it mostly in the recurrent setting based on the 170 data. The other thing you're seeing is it's being used as a single agent, as just
right.
another option, since there's, you know, 20% response.
I mean, do we know about it with chemo in terms of data?
We don't have a lot of data on it.
The single agent data, though, I guess is enough to justify treatment.
It often gets it paid for.
So somebody comes to see you for a second opinion, they've had Bev as a single agent recommended, recurrent disease, I'm assuming you say okay?
In most cases, it depends on where they are in the treatment queue, what they've had before, what
right.
kind of toxicities they had, and so
sure.
on.
Sure, but theoretically,
yeah, largely okay. yes.
What about in the adjuvant setting? They come second opinion, first opinion says, I want to give it with the adjuvant.
Well, I'd really try to encourage them to go on one of the trials because we'd love to know
they're
the
answer
to that.
They're not eligible.
I tend not to, and we've had more difficulty getting it reimbursed in the frontline setting because we don't have any data.
And it's going to be interesting, too, to see what the differences between GYN-oncs and med-oncs who've had a lot of experience with Bev, particularly from colon. I'm assuming they're going to be a lot more likely or comfortable using it.
Yeah, I think they'll be early adapters.
Interesting. I want to ask you about other sort of leads in terms of where things might be heading and some of the things that GOG might be doing in 2-3 years from now, particularly new agents. What about pertuzumab? That one, I'm a little confused about actually what we know about pertuzumab, both clinically and biologically in ovarian cancer.
Yeah. We haven't seen a lot of outstanding activity with most of these drugs as single agents, and that's been a bit of a problem. I think that part of the problem lies with the fact that ovarian cancer, due partially to the number of cases that occur in the United States in a year, has relied largely on some of the molecular harmatias, if you will, of other cancers. And so they've looked at critical pathways in breast or colon and said, well, let's try it in ovary. And so that hasn't necessarily been to the advantage of targeting the most important pathways in ovary in terms of cytotoxicity. So I think that that's been part of the problem. In terms of the drugs that are on their way, a number of trials are out there right now. Certainly the drug that received the most attention last year was the TLK. But this particular compound was very promising, even in platinum-resistant patients, and it appeared that it even made platinum-resistant patients, quote-unquote, platinum-sensitive and so on.
And what kind of agent is it?
It's a glutathione S-transferase inhibitor. Looked very, very promising. And unfortunately, two phase 3 trials came out that were both negative that were actually presented at ASCO this year. So that was something that was certainly on the horizon. In terms of data that we look forward to, there's a monoclonal antibody, OVERX, which we hope to see that data within the next year.
What's an antibody to?
CA125 to the antigen. And the hope there is to really serve as an immunoadjuvant by binding and then creating an immunocascade, increasing cytotoxicity. The data around that, the first phase 3 trial was overall a negative trial, but when they looked at patients that were optimally debulked, they saw a subset that appeared that may have benefited from it, and so they expanded that cohort in a phase 3 fashion to see if there's going to be any difference or not. So we look forward to that data, and that should be coming shortly. The other compound that we hope to see some data on maybe as early as ASCO this year is a drug, trabectedin, which is from C-Squirt, Yondelis is its trade name, and it's been combined with Doxil. So it's a randomized trial of Doxil versus Doxil plus trabectedin. And that data hopefully will be, the trial is closed. It's an international trial with over 600 patients.
What kind of drug is it?
It's a minor groove DNA binder that brings the minor groove towards the major groove. And
what's that mean?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, it sounds pretty high tech.
Edit that out. It's a DNA.
Yeah.
DNA toxic drug. We'll say it's a DNA toxic drug.
Interesting. What about CA125 in terms of its use in monitoring patients, both as they're being treated and to detect progression? How effective is it?
It's very effective. CA125, as you know, is an antibody that's against the antigen, the OC125 antigen, which, out of curiosity, you may not know it, but it was the 125th antigen that was tested. Dr. Bast, then at Duke, was the principal investigator involved with this. And since then, it has had a lot of uses and a lot of misuses in the clinical arena, and we've seen it be, I think, overall much more of a good thing than a bad thing, but we do see some misuses of the test. In terms of how you use it, it's not very good for screening, and there's a number of reasons why that is, but basically it's not sensitive enough and it's not specific enough. And so for those reasons, it's not very good. And in fact, if you look at stage 1 cancers, which is really what you want a screening test to do, is get you to a point where you could cure most of these women, it's only elevated in 50% at best. So as a screening tool, not so good. As a tool that can be used to detect recurrence, it's very effective. So for those patients who have an elevated CA125, which somewhere between 70-80%, depending on their histology, a little less for mucinous, a little more for serous, we find that those women who then have treatment with a subsequent fall in their CA125, who then have a rise in CA125, the chances of them having recurrent tumor is well over 90%.
Enough to change treatment?
Absolutely. And in fact, if we look at what's actually done in the community, these patients will often go on treatment if they have subsequent rises in their CA125. And there's about a 3-month lead time in terms of the CA125 level going up versus what you would see on imaging or what you'll actually detect on physical exam and, of course, ahead of symptoms as well. Now, having said that, what do you do with the patient that comes in and her CA125 level was, say, a nadir of 16, and now she's in your office and it's 25? She says, why is my CA125 level up? What's going on here? Those patients are the longest visit of the day because I try to educate them that we have no data that says treating them immediately is going to make any difference. And so I try to encourage them to have this rechecked. Obviously, you're not going to convince them to wait 3 months, and it's probably prudent not to wait that long. But I try to get them to wait at least another month, and then we recheck it. If I see then that that trend continues to rise, certainly when it gets to triple digits, greater than 100, I will often initiate treatment in that circumstance, even though I don't have any data that says early initiation of treatment makes any difference.
What's the variation in terms of how long it takes to get there, in terms of going up to the point where you'll treat? You're looking at usually a few months, a year or two?
Well, in terms of going from just below normal up to over 100, mm-hmm. it really varies because there's some patients that have tumor that's rapidly growing, and literally within several weeks, you know, they'll come back in and their CA-125 will be 300. There's other patients, they come back in, it was 25, now it's 46, now it's 72. You know, it may take quite a few checks to get them up greater than 100.
And what's the correlation between the actual level or the rise in the level in clinical symptomatology?
Very unusual for the patient to have symptoms with relatively low levels of CA-125. So this is truly a biomarker in that it well precedes symptomatology, probably by as much as 6 months.
So when you look at a woman who dies of ovarian cancer, obviously there's tremendous heterogeneity, but in general, what's sort of the time course about how long it takes from the original diagnosis and how much of that time is symptomatic?
Well, a big part of that is, you know, whether they were optimally or suboptimally debulked. A little bit has to do with the grade of the tumor. A little bit has to do with their age and all the things and recognizing the heterogeneity within that. If you look in terms of averages or medians, you're probably looking at somewhere between, for optimal disease now, aggressively treated, you're really looking at approaching 5 years median survival or longer, depending on the route of therapy. For those that are suboptimally debulked, you're probably looking at somewhere between 2.5 to 3.5 years, somewhere in that order. If you're looking at patients that are, quote, platinum refractory, meaning that they grow through frontline treatment, you're really looking at probably around a year of median survival.
And in the better case scenario, in the 5-year patient with optimal debulking, you know, roughly how much of that time are they asymptomatic versus symptomatic?
Well, the good news is a good majority of it. I mean, with median survival now out over 5 years, that tells you a couple things. It tells you, one, that a significant number of these women are actually being cured, and it may be as high as 25 to 30%.
What are some of the palliative issues with ovarian cancer, and where does hospice fit in?
Well, it's a big part of their care, and the problem, I think, with ovarian cancer, and it's a good problem to have, and it's a problem that I've seen emerge in the last decade, has been that we have so many active options now that we tend to treat third, fourth, fifth line, and we have so many of these patients that still respond, so it's hard for us not to offer treatment, and the patients, of course, want that treatment if they think there's a reasonable chance they're going to respond. The problem with that, though, is recognizing when we're no longer getting a response, and by the time you get the fourth or fifth line treatment, if they failed their last two treatments, the chances of finding something that's going to be successful is extremely low, and I think we need to do a better job of communicating that to the patient and trying to get them to hospice at that point.
What, when people die with ovarian cancer, what is the usual cause of death?
The most common problem is that of the disease burden that affects the small bowel. And so they often have disease either at the root of the mesentery, which tends to strangulate the vasculature, or they have multifocal disease on the bowel loops themselves that cause multiple areas of bowel obstruction. And the bowel just becomes twisted in this tumor morass, and they often can perforate, they often are unable to eat, and a very debilitating disease at the end, often because they tend not to have good nutrition then, and it becomes very difficult.
The last thing I want to ask you about is whether you have any speculations about why ovarian cancer is so sensitive to chemotherapy and, you know, kind of bevacizumab too, it sounds like. What do you think there is about the biology of this disease that causes that?
I don't know. I think that the fact that we recognize it is the first step, and in terms of us being able to offer these patients a number of different treatments that are keeping more women alive for a longer period of time than what we've ever been able to accomplish in the past. And that is partially due to, I think, better surgical techniques, but I also think a big part of that is because we have so many drugs that we can offer to these patients. And as you characterize it, the tumor remains relatively sensitive to a number of these agents. And so I think by sequencing these agents, we can really keep these patients alive for quite a long period.
I've kind of had this impression, and I have no idea if there's any scientific basis to it, that there's a higher growth fraction. I think about the cells and the ascites and stuff, but I don't know if that's been studied or if it's true, is it?
Well, I can really comment on what it is relative to other tumors, because even within the ovarian cancer arena, there's a fair amount of heterogeneity in terms of response.
I mean, in terms of growth fractions or, you know, Ki-67 or stuff like that, is it a faster growing tumor?
These tend to be fairly genetically garbled tumors, which is part of why I think they respond well to cytotoxics, but why we may not see as much single agent tyrosine kinase inhibitors and so on that seem to work on one pathway have success. And I think that certainly the molecular genetics of this may explain some of the outcomes we see with our tools that we have available.